From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's always good to have old friends, even though they're old friends who haven't done the show. And this particular old friend is, I think, has a particular target in the way he works. He is a guy who seems to be drawn to intergenerational conflict in storytelling, be it in Swingtown or 6 Feet Under or The Newsroom or his newest project. The new edition of Tales of the City for Netflix is very much a part of that. My guess is the show's executive producer and director, Alan Poole. So good to have you here.
Thank you. I've been wanting to be here for a long time.
Well, you have a low series of expectations to be met, so I'm glad to have you. But talk to me about this, because this idea of intergenerational and basically tribes claiming language is something you're really drawn to, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's, I've had a significant amount of life experience at this point. And so one of the ways of trying to stay part of the conversation is to own the generation that I'm in and look for dialogue with younger generations, because it's across the board. It's a dialogue that's not happening nearly enough. And so I don't want to be, put out to pasture. So not yet. So this is a good way to keep things lively. And in addition, I've just always been a very language-oriented person. I got my college degree in Japanese literature, and I speak fluent Japanese, and I got into film because of Japanese. And Japanese being such an unusual language, or so different from the Romance languages, that you really have to step outside yourself. You really have to create a different linguistic entity for yourself in order to be able to relate. So the intersection between thought and language and culture is something that's always been very much of interest to me.
But the way that language defines culture is something that's been a part of these shows you've done. And I always thought it was one of the things that attracted you, because even in Armstead Maupin's original stories, that idea of language being a tribal thing is very much a part of the way characters define themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that sweeping generalization number one probably won't be the last one, but Americans are very language bound. We don't, you go to Europe, most people speak a second language, if not a third. And in America, we study some foreign language in college, but unless you're Latino, then you don't usually grow up bilingually.
Or biculturally.
Yeah. And we're very hermetic that way. And so there's not nearly enough programming that looks at the role that language plays in culture, because most Americans don't think outside of their own linguistic box. So how the vocabulary that we choose and the way in which we express ourselves actually determines the nature of our thoughts is something that's always been of interest to me. And I think it's much more in play at the moment, I think, because, one of the things Netflix has done is push more multilingual dramas with their international originals division. And so you have shows like Narcos, where people jump back and forth between languages, and you do get a sense of the different cultural assumptions that underlie the language that you're speaking.
But I guess I find this fascinating, too, just because going back and watching all the shows and just rereading even some of the stuff, it slipped my mind how much language is a part of the way Maupin addresses the world and the way these characters, there is this kind of tribal divide almost between generations in his work.
Yeah, but it's interesting about Armistead is that Armistead grew up and came out and began writing in a world that was very binary and very closeted. So that was a world in which developing your own language was a survival tool. It was the secret handshake.
It was code switching.
Yeah, it was all, we did our own version of gay code switching, yeah. And Armistead was one of the first people to really write about that, and in such an entertaining fashion, and a lot of what he wrote kind of seeped into the cultural vernacular. But it's very different now. And one of the great things about the new series is that we're actually able to deconstruct some of what Armistead did and then reconstruct it for a new generation that is much more gender fluid, much more non-binary, much more inclusive in terms of all the whole spectrum of ethnicity and gender and age and sexuality.
But also the way language sort of really basically intersects and divides these tribes inside Tales of the City is very much a part of it, too. I'm thinking about the way certain words are used and for example—
Are you thinking about the scene?
Yes.
Is that what you're leading me towards?
Oh, yes.
Very nicely done.
Thank you.
You talk about cross-generational. There's a scene. I mean, the show's out. I guess I can give spoilers. But there's a scene in the fourth episode that is a confrontational dialogue between generations of gay men. And it's...
And what's important is that one of the characters central to this is a character who was the youngest in the first iteration.
Yeah, it's a callback to a well-known scene from the original series that we called the A-Gay Dinner Party, where young Mouse, Michael Tolliver, is taken as a guest to a dinner party of older, successful queens. And this was in, you know, taking place in the 70s. And so they were the upholders of the old order and very snobby and very tied into society and very closeted. And Michael is repelled by them. And so, and we did stunt casting for that, where we wanted our own A-gays. So those A-gays were played at the time by Paul Bartel, Lance Loud, Kevin Sesames, and Ian McKellen. And so when we wanted to revisit the scene and make an echo that was relevant to today, I was very interested in the cross-generational dialogue that is not happening, because you had the generation, the binary generation, the gay lesbian generation, and then you had the AIDS crisis, and that became a kind of chasm that really was a fault line between the two generations. And then you have the post-AIDS generation and the millennials who, on the one hand, they issue the old gay lesbian labels. They don't like those labels because they feel they're confining, which in a sense they were, because we were responding to the way that society defined us. And they don't like to be lectured, the young people, and they don't want to be told about all the sacrifices that my generation made so that they can have this incredible sense of entitlement. And it's the sense that for many generations that there was a gay oral history that was passed down from generation to generation, and it was a huge rite of passage everybody went through to learn from your gay elders what it meant and what were the codes and what you could do and what you couldn't do. And that was completely breached by AIDS, because on the one hand, everybody died, or a generation died, and on the other hand, as a result of that, things became much more open and accepting, and the progress happened so rapidly that young people don't want to hear about how oppressed the older people were, and they don't want to hear about the sacrifices. And so I find that there's a mutual suspicion and borderline hostility between the two generations, the older queers and the younger queers. And so this dinner table scene expresses that fairly overtly. And we had our own stunt casting of our A-gays. I mean, now Michael is, of course, of the older generation, but we had Steven Spinella and Taylor Mack and Malcolm Getz and Brooks Ashmankis and Brian Batt and Dan Butler as our A-gays, which is, you know, I know it's a minuscule portion of our viewing audience that will appreciate that, but we do want to play to that portion. There are hardcore fans.
They may even be listening right now. We're talking language with the executive producer of Tales of the City now in its fourth iteration on Netflix, and Ellen Poole, I guess, though, I just find myself, and we've never actually talked about this, I've known you for a while, the fact that language sort of betokens who and what you are, and I'd always thought that finally Tales of the City is about learning to be generous. You know, there's a point where somebody has to sort of say, this is who I am, I've learned to accept it, you should too. And in fact, there's a piece of language that starts the first and last episodes where Mary Madrigal is asked about how things have changed. You say, well, we're flawed and narcissistic and doing
our best. Yeah.
And I thought that was really something that kind of could define almost any character you've been attracted to.
It was pretty much a thesis statement for the show. But I mean, if you look at the world of Armistead, it's all about two things. One is family, that you find your family, especially for certainly previous generations of gay men and women, that you had to find your family and put it together. And then the second thing is no judgment, is that everybody's flawed. Everybody has terrible secrets in their past, which we find out about Anna Madrigal in this iteration. But we're all human and we all need love, and therefore it's not for us to judge. And that sounds kind of sentimental and treacly, but I hope we don't treat it that way. But I do think that the lack of judgment towards characters is one of the things that keeps Tales original, because it's hard to find in today's media landscape.
Also, to that kind of judgment, because since we're talking about language early on, back in the first episode, basically Mary, so there's a conversation about earnestness, and she basically plants a flag for that. And I think what she means to say, and it's this thing that really, for me, defines the show, is that the characters at their best lead with their hearts. And I think she's trying to say that. But earnest becomes this sort of code word for many people who just feel like you're basically being a little bit too stringent.
I've had a lot of people, in praising the show to me, say it's so wonderfully earnest, and I recoil because earnest is a there's a connotation to earnest that is that indicates kind of on the nose and without affect and boring.
But I think, again, I'm just trying to parse language here because I think what I'm talking about, again, is that openness that and being open-hearted. And the flaw that all these characters have is that they all lead with their heart at some point when they shouldn't. Yeah. And that sort of schism between being incredibly articulate and still being lost to emotion is the key part of the struggle.
Yes, and your dictionary definition of earnest is right on point. It's just that there's a certain taint that has clung to the word. So to speak, that I like to avoid. And that's why we put that exchange in where, you know, she says, what's wrong with being earnest? And then Mouse tells her that earnest is bad because our world is ruled by snark. But we are, so I'm trying to think of a replacement word, but, you know, generous of spirit and open-hearted is what we want our calling card to be. Also because it's become unusual in today's narrative world. And it's also the truest expression of Armistead's vision, which I think still can mean a lot to a lot of people.
Interesting, too, more so, I think, than any of the previous versions of the show that you've done. This show feels like it's really used his materials as a taking off point rather than being true to. I mean, you bring in characters that are mentioned in later books like Jake.
Yep.
But also, there's an episode about Anna's origins, I hate to use that word, that really is nowhere to be found. I mean, it's something you can extrapolate.
Basically, when we approached this, there were several fundamental decisions. One question was brought up by Working Title was, should we go back and remake the original, go back to the 70s?
Why would you
do that? And I was
like,
well, that was my response. It was like, not as long as Laura Linney is alive and willing to work, she is Marianne Singleton. And so we put that away. And then the next question was, should we adapt one of the later novels? Because he wrote a final trilogy from 2006 to 2015 and work from there. And the feeling was that we can draw on those books. Those books are great, but they focus more on the characters we knew from the 70s. So they're a little more elegiac in feel. And we needed to appeal to young people and to bring the series in a more meaningful way into the 21st century. And so we used the Marianne Comes Back incident in Marianne and Autumn as a springboard. And then there were certain of the characters that Armistead had created of the younger generation, most notably Ben and Shauna and Jake, that we used. But then around them, we had to augment their world. And then we had to send them on new adventures because we wanted to do a 10-episode series that had its own arc, its own storyline, its own mystery. And in that, the writers are all queer writers' room, which we were very proud of. Very wisely said, if we're going to do a mystery and Marianne's going to play Nancy Drew again, let's have the mystery be about Anna, because there's things we don't know about Anna.
Well, at this point, we're going to take a break and leave our listeners sitting at the edge of their seats as we talk about the new version, the new season, I should say, of Tales of the City on Netflix. Executive producer and director Alan Poole is here. I'm glad to have him here. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking about life with Alan Poole, the executive producer of the new season of Tales of the City and all the previous versions as well. And it's The Treatment. But again, and dealing with Anna here and unfolding that story and really sort of getting it back to, again, that generosity of spirit and owning what you are and owning who you are, no matter – and there's always time to do that. And that ownership of personhood is really key to this season in a way that never has been before.
Yeah, but and I think specifically with Anna, there was, I mean, Armistead did a very brave thing by putting a transgender character at the center of his story back in the 70s when he started writing it. But the level of general knowledge about transgender issues was so low. And Armistead himself, he didn't really have the means to do extensive homework. And so it was what happened to Anna, how Andy became Anna was always just left as a mystery, a blip. There's some mentions I went to Denmark. I went to Denmark and then I came back as a girl. And clearly that doesn't cut it anymore. And also he discovered later that it was anachronistic because at the time period in which Anna would have been having her surgery, Denmark had stopped performing the operation. So then in the last book, Days of Anna Magical, there's some reference to, well, it wasn't really Denmark. But we never told the story. And this is the time to tell the story. And Armistead was thrilled. And it was, he had never...
So you got to talk to him about it.
Oh, we talked extensively about it. Because Armistead's an executive producer on the show. He needed to sign off on every plot line, every new character. And he was very much an enthusiastic participant in the process. And he loved the idea that we would go back and tell Anna's story and tell it in a way that was historically accurate. And we had a lot of help because much more research is available now. Susan Stryker.
Oh, my God. Yes, of course.
Susan Stryker, who made the incredible documentary Screaming Queens, yes, about the Compton Cafeteria Riot, which everybody should watch, came in as a consultant specifically for that episode in terms of what it was like for a trans woman in the 60s.
1966,
the year of Compton's Cafeteria Riots. And when we figured out on the timeline that Anna's transition and arrival in San Francisco would have been around 66, and then there was the Compton's riots, it just became, that's how the episode took shape. And Susan was instrumental in walking us through what would and would not have happened, what decisions a trans woman at that time would and would not have been able to make for herself.
And also by having in Jake having another modern trans character who's very much aware of who and what he is, but also there are different pulls now, and he could acknowledge those pulls in a way that that person might have been too afraid to. And in fact, I don't know if I've ever seen this. I've seen it in fiction, but I've never seen it in film before, that story being told.
A Jake story?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think I have either. And it's interesting. One of the ways we modified it.
And we should talk about this. This is a fact. This is a character, a trans character, who's now coming to terms with the fact that he may be attracted to men.
Yeah, which is different from the way it is in the book.
Very much so.
But it's in all the research we did, found it's a not uncommon story that you have a trans man who, when he transitions, who had previously been a lesbian and been in a same-sex couple, and then when he transitions, finds that he actually becomes attracted to men. And it's something that is kind of wonderful in the sense that it's awe-inspiring in terms of all the potential of human nature. And some people say it's because of the testosterone. Some people say it's just because of the new awareness and attraction to his own new body, and it's probably some combination, but it's not an aberrant story. It's a story of something that happens, and we really wanted to go through it with Jake and try to present it in, again, non-judgmental way.
Yeah, because I guess I found myself thinking, too, that more than the others, because there was so much anger, especially in the first season of the show, there was a lot of anger. And this one, there seems to be a lot of people finding ways to forgive themselves, and including Mary.
Yeah, well, you know, Marianne's journey is always at the heart, and a lot of people felt that we kind of overdid ourselves in terms of making her abrasive in the first two episodes.
I thought it was even funny, though, the way you introduced her is really kind of funny. She's basically hiding in plain sight, and you say you directed that episode. It's a great reveal, by the way.
Well, I had to give Laura an entrance. It's Laura Linney coming back as Marianne. I had to give her a little bit of an entrance. Thank you for appreciating that. But she comes in as someone who, let's say, all of her years in Connecticut have not made her into a more perceptive person at the point at which we enter. And then we take her on this wonderful journey.
And you also take her daughter on a similar journey as well. I mean, again, there are so many kinds of points of contrast. So basically taking versions of the same character in different points in her life, from Jake to Anna to Marianne to her daughter. I mean, that is really something, too, that I found that makes this distinctive from the seasons that have come before.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I feel like the seasons that came before – I feel like everybody had very satisfying journeys, but I will say the first season is one I'm most proud of. Seasons 2 and 3, which are still very entertaining, they lean harder into the sort of mystery that was always part of Tales, and so it gets a little too genre-fied, like, oh my God, they're cannibals, right? And then when we were figuring out the mystery for this season, we were like, yeah, no Jim Jones, no cannibals. Armistead had to lead into the sensational a little bit more because he was writing a newspaper serial every day and he had to keep it alive. So we had a chance to really re-envision things. And also we were on our own in terms of figuring out the character arcs. We weren't tied to the page of what had been written as a serialized newspaper column.
Was that a good thing for you to have that kind of liberation?
Okay. I think it was a great thing. I think for Lauren Morelli, our showrunner, and The Room, they were able to look at the show holistically and figure out thematically what the show needed and what the characters needed, instead of having to follow a dance plan that was already on the floor.
But I was thinking in that episode, there's a claim, a sort of a generational claim, or rather, I guess really is sort of like planting a flag about a certain word that Zosia's character uses, and she said, well, that's a denigrating word to women. You can't say that anymore. So even...
I guess you can't say it on NPR either.
You can, but let's not cause any trouble. But, I mean, that's a continual sort of fact that world is evolving.
Yeah.
And in fact, what I'm saying about this is, in this season, more than the others, is that Barbary Lane is not as hermetic a place as it once was.
No. And we see the outside world crashing in on it.
Literally.
In the course of the series, yeah. And Barbary Lane had to be endangered, of course, because that is clearly, it's a prime piece of real estate in San Francisco now. To ignore that would have been to make it a complete fantasy. And it's still a fantasy, but I think we included that, the real estate story, in an interesting way. But, you know, also in this generation, when you talk about language, we are all grappling now with having to adjust our language with regard to pronouns, with regard to the ways in which you can refer to transgender folk. And a lot of people feel it's a lot of political correctness, but it's actually necessary in order to give people who are emerging into the world their proper dignity. And I think we dealt hands-on with the sense of about what people can be called and not be called, because it's confusing for everybody. It's confusing within the community, and it's really confusing for people who are not in the community. And that goes back to the use of the word tranny in that dinner scene, that we wanted to make a point of the fact that there are ways that we routinely and humorously refer to people that are actually doing damage in ways we may not be thinking about.
It's a treatment. My guest was using words I can't use is Alan Poole. He's the executive producer of Tales of the City, which is now in its fourth season on Netflix. But I guess I just find myself thinking, too, that idea of looking for a home, which is so central to all these shows that you've done, people trying to find a home for themselves in the modern world, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out what parts of the past to hold on to and what parts to discard. Those, to me, are really, I don't want to say conventions, but certainly literary approaches to fiction that I find you've been so often gravitating towards in the way to tell stories for television.
Well, I mean, for me, and it's a little bit of an old-fashioned position because TV has changed so much, but for me, traditionally in good television, character is story. The story does not overrule character, and the story comes from character, and character is why people continue to watch a continuing series. And so if you find, I've always been drawn to stories that have really rich characters who are in conflict with themselves and with each other, and that will most often involve some kind of familial situation, because those are the people that we love the most and have the most conflict with. But it's really the idea that, you know, I feel like long-running TV series, the way that they hit the wall is when they suddenly start having characters do uncharacteristic things in order to make the story work. Witness final season of Game of Thrones. I mean, that's all that was, right? So it's like jumping the shark to me is not a Fonzie thing. It's about when suddenly you sense that you're not, the character is doing something that doesn't feel quite right for them so that the plot can move to this place. And that to me is like, that's the cardinal sin. I never want to do that.
Rather than dwelling on Game of Thrones, what I will say is...
Okay. I didn't mean we were going to go there. It's just
You went there.
It just came to mind.
I'm just watching you pull off as I stand on the curb. But I do think so a point of fascination for you is characters grappling with the modern world. Mm. And how do they interact with it, or do they choose to interact with it? And for Marianne, so much that still is finding a way to kind of hide away from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, just... the timbre of her voice changes by the last episode. Yeah. I mean, she's no longer a pinging and sounding like Mary Tyler Moore and being assaulted with that earnestness, in fact, which is where that abrasion comes from. And that's my question for you, is that interest in people who are in their way anachronistic and making these choices that sort of say, well, why do I have to be part of this thing that doesn't make sense to me?
Well, I think it's incumbent on all of us to question how much of the externals of our contemporary life is something that we should just unconsciously accept and go with the flow, and how much do we want to actually pick out our own values, especially today. Well, you know, the I mean, I don't want to start sounding like an old guy, but I feel like there used to be a kind of, the zeitgeist used to contain a sense of overarching values that we all need to aspire to, common values. And I feel like that's, our world is fractured now, so fractured that even that has gone away. So if we can show people questioning their own values and questioning the values of others and trying to find what's the right combo platter that makes you be able to live comfortably today, but live also as a significant citizen and a thinking person. I think that's, I mean, isn't that the task that everybody has to approach?
I think you're right, but I think then these dramas that you've been attracted to as producer, oftentimes these protagonists are kind of being sort of bowled over by the modern world and are really kind of fighting to hold on to this piece of self that they're afraid will be sublimated, subsumed by the modern world.
Well, they're not hip. That might be a reflection of self, but I choose not to think so. But yeah, I think that, well, I mean, it's not even the modern, you look at Swingtown, and that was about...
But that world was, the modern world of that era.
Yeah. And it's also what's one of the things that I love about Swingtown is it's taking place in the exact same year as the first Tales of the City.
Cities, yeah.
And yet it's two different universes. And so you can say 1976, but you see what it was like for suburban Chicagoans who were upwardly mobile and straight, and what it was like for a bohemian community in San Francisco. And the same issues arise. The same issues of how much of this new morality do I accept?
But that, and you just touched on something that really defines, I think, in a lot of ways, all these things that you've been attracted to, is that fear of too much freedom.
Yeah.
And the comfort and constraint.
Yeah. Well, the reason that family is always such a theme is that family is where we find structure. And without structure, we kind of, you know, fall off the grid. So that we all want, I believe, in as much personal freedom as possible for each individual. But obviously, there has to be some kind of structure. And that structure, if that structure comes from a web of loving relationships of people who do not judge you, as opposed to coming from some external social or political apparatus, it's the former is much the way we live as fulfilled human beings.
Because there's some part of it, almost in some ways, feels like the Stockholm syndrome or loving your captor. You know, it's easier to just not shake off these bonds because at least, you know, it's the evil you know.
Well, aren't we all kind of living in a Stockholm syndrome world right now?
I think we're trying to escape it, but that's another conversation. My guest, who is a much more optimistic person than would have you believe, is Alan Poole. He's executive producer of the new season, the terrific new season, by the way, of Tales of the City on Netflix. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLaguerre. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm going to go find myself some more boundaries. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.